Salo Falava. I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
Aloha kākou, I ora nā, whakaravalahi atu and good morning. This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. I'm your host, Agatha Bowe, and on this Tuesday morning, our show comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Coming up on the show, Tonga has a new Prime Minister. There's concerns from across the Pacific over calls for nuclear weapons testing to resume, and after 180 years, the remains of a Fijian chief have been returned home. Those stories and more right here on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. Firstly, for just the second time since 2010, Tonga has a noble Prime Minister. Lord Whakawhanua was elected to the top job after winning the majority of votes in yesterday's Prime Minister's election. He won 16 of the 26 votes, defeating caretaker Prime Minister Aisake Eke for the position. Lord Whakawhanua told the ABC's Marion Kupu he intends to stabilise Tongan politics by uniting noble MPs and the people's representatives in the legislature. Assembly.
Firstly, Lord Whakawhanua, how do you feel after being announced as Prime Minister?
I feel like I have the trust of our members of Parliament, and I was very genuine when I wanted to unite the members so we can pave a brighter future.
You constantly said unification. What are your intention on how you're going to unite the nobles and the people's representative in the next 4 years?
My intention is to form a cabinet that consists of the best of the 26, so we can have a united front and face the challenges that Tonga needs to overcome in the future.
Yeah, lastly, I know it's a bit too early to tell, but what would be your main priorities, say, in the first month of in office?
I think the main priority is to establish stability and continuity of government. Obviously, there's a lot of work to do, and I hope to get back to you with further details. I just want to thank the Tongan people for giving me their trust through their members of parliament, and I just want to empower them and wish them a very good Christmas.
And that was Tonga's new Prime Minister, Lord Whakawhanua, speaking just minutes after he was announced as the country's new Prime Minister. Now, for more on this, we're joined by Lopeti Senduli, a political commentator and former advisor to former Tongan Prime Minister Akaris Pohiva. With that, I say, malo tau mai bumbongini, Lopeti.
Malo tau mai bumbongini.
Thank you very much for joining us. Lopeti, could you just maybe tell us about Tonga's new Prime Minister? What is it that we need to know?
Well, first thing, he comes after almost 15, 16 years as the Speaker of the Assembly of our Parliament. And he joined the Parliament when he was only 24 years old and became Speaker when he was 27, after he inherited the title from the nobility title from his father, who was prematurely. Well, he had a medical condition, and he inherited the nobility title as a young man, and he has grown over the years, and he has I think he is well equipped to become a good Prime Minister, but at the moment he still has to work on a lot of work to do.
Well, Lopeti, do we know how many nobles and how many MPs actually from the people's representatives actually backed Lord Whakawhanua in yesterday's vote?
What we know is that there were 16 votes in his favor and 10 against his competitor, Dr. Aeke. And out of that 16, the six nobles and 10 peoples. So one thing we have to, your listeners must remember is that in our reform in 2010, we had gone from a government in which His Majesty the King had absolute power, executive power. And he appointed the prime minister, he appointed all the ministers, he, of course, he appointed some very key positions in government, like the ministers for commissioner of police, etc. But in 2010, that became, the absolute power became one of shared responsibility between the king and an elected prime minister. So we have been living with that shared responsibility or shared executive authority between the king and the prime minister. Mm-hmm. So this is a situation that we have. And what I see is that we are slowly, slowly going back to the original, to the pre-reform days in which the king is reasserting his powers, executive powers that had been given over to the prime minister and the elected cabinet. Mm-hmm. And that's not a very, very that's not a very welcome thought, because you see, one of the reasons why there was a lot of public support for the reform is because the public felt that the absolute power, executive authority being absolute authority in the king, that meant that a lot of things were gotten away with without public scrutiny. And we felt that public scrutiny was what was missing. And we are going back to those pre-reform days in which the king is asserting more authority over the elected parliament. And that's not a very nice situation. For example, the sale of passports to... initially, it was the sale happened at the time when Hong Kong was going to be handed back to Beijing and no longer a British colony. So a lot of Hong Kong residents were purchasing the passports with the prospect of getting citizenship in another country. And the way they saw it is that this was the way of getting access, say, to Australia or to New Zealand and other Commonwealth countries.
Yes, so, Lopeti, can I just bring it back to, obviously, you know, there is an opinion that having the Lord Fafanua as MP is a bit of a backward step. I mean, you know, this is really the first noble prime minister since 2010. What impact do you think this will have on Tonga's democracy?
It is a setback. That's the way I see it. But as I said, he has developed the skills required for the leadership position. He has developed the skills as a democratically elected leader, but at the same time, he is a member of the nobility clan, and that is that can be there is an inherent conflict of interest in there, because to use an example, transparency is one of the cornerstones of democratic governments. being a noble, transparency is not a required characteristic of a noble, because the decisions that nobles make don't necessarily have to be approved or accepted by the public, you see? So we have this then, this prime minister who is a noble, and you have the crown prince who is, well, he is not, well, the crown prince who is not yet appointed as the new, to continue as the Minister of Foreign Affairs. But there it is. So the prospect of that happening is very real.
I was just going to say, Lopeti, do you worry then that Lord Fafanua, you know, being a career politician of noble blood, might prevent him from understanding the concerns of everyday people?
He does. He understands the problems that people face every day. But the question is whether or not he will act in the people's interests, or whether he will act in the interests of His Majesty and the nobility.
So then what do you think then should be his priority once he gets into office? Like, what should he be focusing his attention on?
Well, first of all, he's got to work a coalition of ministers in his cabinet that covers the field. In other words, people that were in the human rights and democracy movement and that has pushed for change, and to ensure also that there is a balance of power between His Majesty the King and an elected prime minister. For example, he was asked yesterday about whether he is willing to appoint former prime ministers like Seth Sovereigny and Dr. Eke as his deputies. And those two are from, you know, very politically different. And his answer was, anything is possible. So if that is a possibility, then we have a good chance of having a good, stable government in which the issues that people want is thoroughly discussed and thought out.
Well, Lopeti, finally, how do you think most ordinary Tongans, you know, are receiving this news about Lord Fagafonor being the new prime minister? I mean, you're on the ground there. What have the conversations been?
No, the as you know, the average Tongan is a royalist. In other words, they support His Majesty and monarchical rule. And they also support the nobility and the class structure that we have. And when it works well, it works well. But when it screws up, like as has happened before, it can be prospects for violence.
Well, look, I just want to say thank you very much, Lopeti, for joining us this morning. That's all the time that we have. But mālo apito hosi ikau mai ke pokalama he pongpongini.
Mālo apito.
Thank you. That is Lopeti Senthuli, political commentator and former advisor to former Tongan Prime Minister Akiris Pohiva.
Join Sose Fo'amoli every Tuesday afternoon for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent, mixed with the sounds and vibe you'll love by artists from across the seas as well. Tune in to Sister Sounds, Tuesday afternoon at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
15 to 11, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, a complaint has been lodged against a Japanese megabank for its decision to back and raise finance for a gas project in Papua New Guinea. Filed by six international organisations, the formal complaint is the first to be submitted to the Equator Principles, a risk management framework used by financial institutions to assess and manage environmental and social risks. The Papua LNG gas project is slated to take place in the Gulf province. Currently in its proposal phase, the final investment decision for the fossil gas project is expected to be made next year. The Director of Environmental Justice at Jubilee Australia Research Centre, Shona Hawkes, wrote and submitted the complaint and told Lucy Cooper the bank is in clear breach of the principles.
That complaint was put forward on the basis that the project doesn't adhere to the standards which are outlined in the Equator Principles, which is 10 key principles. The complaint outlines that six of those don't appear to be being met. And those principles are basically designed to help banks manage environmental and human rights risks when financing projects, with the view that if these aren't properly addressed, they can also expose banks to financial or even legal risks as well.
What are the Equator Principles?
Yeah, so there's a set of standards that 130 financial institutions have adopted. They've been around for about 20 or so years, and they've been designed with the intention of supporting financial institutions to manage legal or financial risks by avoiding unnecessary environmental or human rights risks in the projects that they finance as well. Obviously, as human rights and environmental organisations, we're concerned about the impacts of the project on people and nature, but it also aligns with concerns that financial institutions themselves have by adopting these principles.
And so when a company becomes a member of the Equator Principles or signs up to them, what are they necessarily agreeing to uphold?
So if you go into the weeds of it, there are 10 separate principles, and each of those principles involve various conditions and standards. And we go into a lot of depth of this in the complaint. So some of them relate to respecting Indigenous people's rights, to managing biodiversity risks, a commitment to make certain documents transparent, and commitments to properly engage with people who will be affected by projects as well. The Equator Principles are voluntary, they're non-binding, but if a financial institution is saying that it's managing its risks by applying the Equator Principles and it actually isn't, that may be perceived as misleading conduct or even greenwashing, dependent on the jurisdiction.
The company in question facing this complaint is a Japanese megabank. It's the Mitsubishi UFJ Financial Group. How is this complaint saying that this group has breached the Equator Principles?
So the complaint is addressed to MUFG Bank, but also any other potential bank that may be involved in financing to the project as well. So one of the problems that we have is typically banks don't disclose what they finance until after they've made that financing decision as well. So it was really important for us to be clear that this also applies to any bank who might be involved in the deal that we're not aware of. So MUFG is reported to be the financial advisor to the project. And as detailed in the complaint, there's been various efforts made over the last 2 years to alert MUFG Bank to the risks of the project. And then what we did in the complaint is we went exhaustively through each of the Equator Principles, and we found that six of them don't appear to be being met. So that can range from things like certain documents don't appear to be public, which are meant to be public. So things like environmental impact statements, there doesn't appear to be a current human rights impact assessment or another document called a climate change risk assessment. To also highlighting other risks. We're particularly concerned about Indigenous people's rights. We also raised some really serious concerns about biodiversity, and we looked at the project, and there's an extraordinary amount of biodiversity risks. So that's some of the material that was covered in the complaint.
A complaint under these principles has never been submitted before. This is unprecedented. If the Japanese mega bank in question is found of breaching the principles, what repercussions will it face?
Yeah, so if it is found to breach the principles, basically it would be extremely difficult for the bank to justify a further role in the project. If itself at a company level has identified these are the specific tools that we use to manage risks in our business, if the Equator principles sort of clearly said, hey, you're not applying these principles, then it would make it very, very difficult for the bank to say that they're meeting their own standards.
And that there is Shona Hawkes, Director of Environmental Justice at Jubilee Australia Research Centre, speaking with Lucy Cooper. Now, there are renewed concerns across the Pacific after US President Donald Trump calls for nuclear weapons testing to resume. And for places like Marshall Islands, Ma'ahi Nui and Kiribati, they are still dealing with the effects of past tests. So, will the Pacific become a testing ground again? To discuss this more is PhD candidate at the Australian National University and independent researcher for environmental justice in Oceania in Ma'ahi Nui, French Polynesia. It's Vihia Wheeler. With that, I say, Iorana Vihia, welcome to the show.
Iorana, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Look, why is even the suggestion of resuming nuclear testing so alarming for the Pacific?
Yeah, it's actually alarming for the world in general, because the nuclear testing and nuclear weapons use has been on basically a moratorium, like basically not has not been used since the 1990s. So whether that be in testing or any other sort of use, but so that's about 30 years ago. And so with Donald Trump proposing this offhandedly and very nonchalantly, it's very alarming because it's just not something that is feasible or a norm now in this world of 2025. We just know too much about nuclear impacts in order to for the world to be okay with that restarting again.
Vihia, you know, like for some of our listeners who may not know the history, I'd love for you to, you know, sort of share like when and how long did the actual, you know, sort of testing last there in Ma'ahi Nui itself?
Yeah, the testing in Ma'ahi Nui started in 1966 and lasted until 1996. So it's actually quite a long time. It was a 30-year period of nuclear weapons use. And where it ended 30 years ago, but we're still dealing with the health and environmental impacts of that and the social upheaval that it caused to our society, because it was a very traumatic time to, you know, to have bombs conducted on you over a 30-year period. Mm-hmm. So it's, it's something that's not okay to do in this day and age.
Yeah, and this is the thing. What has been, because you spoke about the health impacts, what's been the evidence of that? You know, they're like, for the likes of like even, you know, countries like Marshall Islands, again, Ma'ahi Nui, even Kiribati, like how much has it affected the culture, the land? Are you able to share on that?
Yeah, as obviously Pacific people, we're people that live with our land. I mean, people that go fishing, we rely on the land and our ocean for our survival. You know, this is how we've been living for thousands of years in this area of the world. So the fact that nuclear bombs were exploded in Oceania on our islands or close to our islands, islands that where people live, it's basically polluted the land and the environment and the ocean and the fish that we eat for lifetimes. I mean, for thousands of years. So that's still what we're dealing with here in Tahiti and Marshall Islands and Kiribati, is that we have environmental impacts such as polluted fish, polluted coral, a polluted ocean, radioactive land, and that impacts our health in ways that are tremendous and intergenerational as well. So we're dealing with higher rates of cancer. We're dealing with higher rates of women's illnesses, such as fertility issues, such as endometriosis, and nuclear testing, or the radioactivity that is a result of nuclear weapon use, has so many health impacts that we don't even actually fully understand at this point how much we're impacted.
Yeah, and then, you know, when we look at the history of it all across the Pacific, do you then feel like even, you know, the US and even, you know, the French who were involved in testing too, like, do you think they fully have acknowledged or even taken responsibility for the harm that was caused by these testings?
No. I'll say no for all of those countries. Even though us in Mohinui, the testing or the nuclear weapon use was caused by the country of France, and that's different than what happened in Marshall Islands. They received nuclear testing by the U.S., and then in Kiribati, it was the U.S. and the U.K. But in all of our cases, we continue to fight with these countries in order to have more rights when it comes to nuclear testing. And so that includes the full recognition of what they've done. And that includes also the full transparency of what they've done. A lot of the information during that time was classified military archives, so it's hidden from a lot of our population. And then also taking full accountability for what they've done, which is the radiation exposure on our lands, and then also the health impacts. So we need better healthcare in all of these places in order to fully deal with the nuclear impacts.
Yeah, Vahia, like you brought up a little bit earlier about the, you know, there is the global moratorium, right? And we know that that's been in place since 1992. And reading through it, obviously it's speaking about the banning of nuclear testing in all environments for all time. Then to hear this call out from, you know, the US President, Donald Trump, is the US then in violation of this?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. The U.S. is in violation of a lot of things, but they just don't take accountability for it. And on the international level, that's quite alarming because the U.S. has so much power. And at this point, Donald Trump seems to just put in place whatever he wants, even when it comes to deep sea mining, even when it comes to nuclear testing, military buildup. It seems like he doesn't have a really clear respect for other nations and what the impacts would be of that. So it's very, and then internationally, it's hard to hold them accountable because they have so much power and wealth that, you know, there is no real way to see, way to put them, hold them accountable or to stop them from what they're doing.
Well, there's also been talks about, you know, there's the Marshallese activists. I'm sure you're aware of Benedict Gumboa, you know, Madison. He's actually called on the US government, you know, to release the Marshall Islands nuclear testing records. Do you agree with this? And what do you think this would mean?
Oh, absolutely. Benedict and his NGO work very closely with our Mohinui activists for nuclear justice as well. So we actually, and we work on together as well. And we're both supportive of that initiative, of what he's saying is on their side from the US, they need to fully release the records of what they've done. And in our side with France, they also need to fully release the records of what they've done, these classified military archives, which continue to hide the truth about what happened. And so a lot of us live in ignorance about what happened. And that's not a good place to be at when you're dealing with all of the health and environmental impacts.
Yeah. And Vahia, is there any sort of level of restitution that you think needs to be made? And how would that look like?
Yeah, definitely. It's an ongoing process, so it really has to be that the countries that conducted these nuclear weapons use and testing, that they, first of all, apologize and take full responsibility on that, just acknowledging it. So in Mohinui, French Polynesia, that hasn't happened yet. France is not fully, has never released an apology statement, for example, for what they've done. And so the fact that they don't, it may seem small, but the fact that they don't even admit that they did any wrongdoing leaves them in a place to continue to deny what we're going through. So firstly would be to make an official statement of saying, we're sorry that we did this. And then from there, the future would be environmental remediation, truth telling about the history, and then better medical facilities so our people don't have to leave in order to get proper medical care.
And what then, finally, Vihir, what then would the Pacific itself need to be doing? Like, what should they be asking of the US government to not even, think about having to resume nuclear testing?
Yeah, it's actually very powerful when the Pacific comes together in order to make statements and show its regional power. So we would love if other Pacific nations, through the Pacific Island Forum, for example, to make a statement against the U.S. creating, just restarting nuclear testing's use. And then from there, there's other things that the Pacific Island Forum or the leaders could do jointly if it becomes more of an issue. Right now, I don't know if it will become an issue because Donald Trump said it once, and I'm not sure that there's any follow-through. But in the case that there is anything that's a future possibility, the Pacific leaders need to think very, very seriously about how they could make statements, embargoes, put pressure on the U.S. in order to not do that.
Look, Vihir, that's all the time that we have, but a great conversation and something that I know our listeners will find very beneficial. So again, I just want to say thank you very much for your time this morning.
Yeah, and thank you so much for listening and having us have a voice about this.
Absolutely. That is Vihir Wheeler, PhD candidate at the Australian National University and independent researcher for environmental justice in Oceania and Mauhinui, French Polynesia. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Yes, I'm joined in the studio by our producer, Kyle Evans. We were going to head around the region, get some stories. How are you doing, sir?
I'm well. I think I'm out of holiday mode now after my lovely trip away to the Gold Coast last couple of weeks.
Back to life, back to reality, eh?
That's right.
Well, let's head to Fiji because this one's interesting. They could be at risk of losing millions of dollars in aid over its failure to clamp down on controversial religious group. Grace Road, what's happening here?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, this one. So the US government is threatening to downgrade Fiji to the lowest possible ranking on its global human trafficking index, which would put at risk millions of dollars in development aid potentially. So this is reported by the Organized Crime and Corruption Project, who spoke to the US State Department. And the downgrade has been threatened over Fiji's failure to crack down on the religious group Grace Road, which the State Department alleges could be involved with transnational organized crime.
Wow.
So as things stand now, Fiji is on the tier 2 watch list of the Global Human Trafficking Index. However, if it gets downgraded to tier 3, which is the baseline, it would essentially put them in the same company as countries like Cambodia and North Korea, probably not where you want to be from a reputational standpoint.
But I'm wondering, so what would relegation to tier 3 mean then, for this whole humanitarian aid?
Yeah, so according to the report, it would potentially cut off all non-humanitarian US assistance. It could also lead the US to pressure lenders like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to end funding to the country as well. So as things stand now, Fiji has until the end of March March to show improvements or face that automatic downgrading. So, yeah, we'll see what happens there.
Absolutely. Okay, well, look, I'm speaking of Fiji. I believe there's more than 159 Fijian peacekeepers who will arrive home from the Middle East this week.
That's right, Aggie. So Fiji is withdrawing 156 peacekeepers, to be exact, from Iraq. Now, the Fiji Sun has confirmed the soldiers will arrive home on Friday this week after speaking to the Secretary for Defence. And it comes after the United Nations Assistance Mission officially shut down operations earlier this month after 22 years of helping Iraq recover from that instability following the 2003 US-led invasion to overthrow Saddam Hussein, which seems like a very long time ago now, yeah. Doesn't it? After growing up with that war very much in the background. Since then, though, Fiji has been a regular fixture on the peacekeeping front, having sent more troops and police per capita to serve UN peacekeeping operations than any other country in the world. So, look, mission accomplished to them. And like I said, Iraq, it's not a place that you hear a lot about in the news anymore, is it? So,
No. But, yeah, look, I'm sure the 156 that have made it back home, they're pretty much happy to be home. Okay, look, we head to Tuvalu's first climate migrants. They've actually finally touchdown here in Australia.
Yeah, quite historic, this one, Aggie. This relocation has now begun with the first batch of migrants leaving Tuvalu for Australia under a historic new climate visa. Now, for background, this was a deal forged between the two countries to preserve Tuvaluan culture as atoll succumbs to rising sea levels. It was a landmark visa with more than a third of the nation's 11,000 citizens applying to relocate. However, only 280 were selected for the first intake. And now that intake has reached Australian shores, Aggie.
Gosh, what kinds of people have actually made up that first intake?
So according to the Australian government, it's a real mix. There's dentists, we have a pastor, and even Tuvalu's first female forklift driver, I found quite interesting. I don't think she'll have too much trouble getting work in Australia. And from the looks of things, they'll settle all over the country as well. So the pastor, for instance, he'll live in the small town of Narracourt in South Australia, which houses several hundred Pacific seasonal workers. Others will settle in places like Melton in Melbourne, where a Tuvaluan community exists.
Yes.
And like I said, it's all to preserve Tuvaluan culture, which is under threat from climate change. In fact, scientists project that half of Tuvalu's main atoll of Funafuti will be underwater by 2025. So the sooner people can come over, adapt and establish themselves, the more we can preserve their way of life.
Oh, I'd love to probably maybe get someone to see if they could just come and talk to us, right, about the journey and the transition.
It'd be fantastic, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Melton's not too far from where we are, Aggie, that's for sure.
Okay. Oh, well, look, thank you very much, Carl, as always, for bringing us our news from around the region here on Pacific Beat.
Talofa Lava, this is Sose Fuamoli from Sister Sounds and On The Record, wishing you a merry and bright Christmas wherever you're celebrating across the Pacific, and all the very best for the year ahead. I can't wait to share more great music and stories with you in 2026.
What it is, Marolele, it's Haola Tukefu from In The Fale, wishing you a peaceful, joyful Christmas and a happy new year. 2025 has been full of good vibes and great tracks, and I can't wait to bring you even more music to come in 2026 on ABC Radio Australia.
Hi, this is Rick Howe from Island Music, wishing you and your loved ones a peaceful Christmas and joyful New Year. I've loved sharing the best in Pacific music with you this year, and I look forward to bringing you even more unforgettable Pacific music in 2026 on ABC Radio Australia.
Are the solemn hymns marking the final return of one of their own. Some 180 years after he was taken, the remains of Fijian chief Rovi Ndovi returned to his ancestral land in Rewa province. Accused of killing a group of American traders in 1840, Rovi Ndovi was arrested, convicted and taken to the US, where he died months after arriving. His skull was kept at the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, D.C., and his remains were buried at a naval cemetery. But over the weekend, the traditional protocols were carried out as Rovi Ndovi's remains returned home. So joining us this morning for more on this story is Dr. Teresi Vundilo, an anthropologist and museum specialist. She is an assistant professor at the California State University in Los Angeles. With that, I say Yandra Vinaka, Teresi. Yeah, thank you for joining us. Teresi, what was your reaction when watching this event, especially when it was being live streamed over the weekend?
Yes, it's been, a long time coming because we have been, waiting for this occasion to happen for a couple of decades. And it was kind of, a happy occasion, particularly for the family and also for Fiji.
Yeah. I mean, again, what was the actual significance of the event? You know, like, why was it so important for the people of Rewa?
I think it's, reminding the people of Rewa on, the important role that they played during the colonial days, and they've always been in the forefront, in the protection of our indigenous rights, and also the resistance that was played out in the early 1800s, was very powerful on lots of levels, and in many times as Itoke people, we often don't talk about what our ancestors did back then. Mm. So what actually happened was, it's a reminder that our people were not easy to, be pushed around, or to be bossed around or to be bullied. There were chiefs who stood their ground against any, outside external forces. And Rovi Ndovi was an example of that.
Yeah. I mean, and that's it, Teresi. How important was the Rovi Ndovi to Fijian history? Given that, he came to prominence at the time of first contact, really, right, between Fijians and colonial powers.
Absolutely, because he, he belonged to the Wubale, or the family of the Rokotindoketi, which is, a paramount family in the province of Rewa. And Rewa, up until today, still play a very important role on a Vanua level, but also on the political level for the whole nation. And, having Rovi Ndovi, leave Fiji, to be exiled and then coming back home, especially at this time, in this very, political, uncertainty for the country, it is, a very welcoming event, because to remind us as indigenous people of Fiji, that we did play a very important role back then during the colonial days, and we still do play a very important role in this time, particularly the Confederacy of Muramasanga.
Mm-hmm. But what's interesting is, there's still great debate about his crime, isn't there? Like whether he was innocent or not over the crime. Is that still the case today?
I think the debate will, continue on. But from, my perspective as an indigenous Itoke, there's always two sides to a story. He'll be, looked upon as, as a criminal or whatever word that a non-Itoke would like to place upon someone else. But for us as a people, he's, from my perspective, he's a hero. He's someone that, stood there and took all the blame. And for me, seeing him, and reading about him and seeing what happened back then and seeing how he put his hand up, and said, take me. It's me who is responsible for everything that happened. Mm. It just shows his quality of a leader. And I think our younger generation of today, for Fiji, we need to learn more about him. And his story needs to be included in the educational curriculum so that his stories are not forgotten.
Teresi, let's talk about, you know, this repatriation now. Like, how long do you think it took to actually, you know, get that permission and to arrange to repatriate his remains?
Yes, you know, in 2012, when I first started my PhD journey at the University of Auckland in New Zealand, I had the privilege of attending the Festival of Civic Arts in Honiara in the Solomon Islands. And I was very fortunate to be sitting next to the late Adrienne Kepler. You know, she's a well-known, you know, curator and ethnologist. And during our conversation in Honiara, I still remember it like it was yesterday. You know, we were talking about Rovindovi. And she knew that I was doing my PhD and my topic was on repatriation. So she looked right straight to me and she said, "I think you're the one who's going to work hard and bring Rovindovi home." Mm. And it was like a prophecy, if I can say that word. Mm. And so I kept that challenge within me. And when my journey of doing my PhD started, you know, I went to my PhD supervisor, who's Professor Stephen Rotuva at the University of Canterbury now, but he was in Auckland back then. You know, I talked about Rovindovi and I said, "I want to include him in my thesis." And he said, "No, don't include him because he's talking about human remains. You should only talk about cultural artifacts." Anyway, I pushed my way in as I would and as I could, and I ended up including his story in my thesis, you know, for your information, because I felt, and I still remember that challenge by Adrian Kepler. Wow. Anyway, fast forward to 2024, last year, I was invited by the Smithsonian Museum to be one of the fellows at their CIMA fellowship that they hold every year. And I would like to acknowledge publicly the director of CIMA, Dr. Joshua Bell. And for your information, I've been wanting to attend this fellowship for a number of years and I always get declined. So I lost hope. Mm. But last year, I was invited. And I asked him, "What would you like me to do?" And he said, "Would you be able to study about Rovindovi and include her, you know, him in your study?" And I said, "Of course I will. I'd love to." So I spent a month in Washington, D.C., reading up about him and the Wilkes expedition. And we were able eventually to see him, his remains. I have to say that the stars were aligned, you know, because I knew from 2012 when I was talking to Adrian Kepler, and in between, there were discussions of repatriation, but it often comes up and then it dissipates. You know, it comes up and then nobody wants to take it on, until I came into the picture last year. Mm. And I was there for a month. And fortunately, if I would say that word, I finally found out through Mr. Sudhu, Mr. and Mrs. Sudhu, who live in Washington, that the Fiji ambassador just arrived into the country, into the U.S. And did you know that the Smithsonian Museum has a rule that for ancestral remains, that only the direct lineage can access the collection? If you don't have direct lineage, you will never view or see them.
Wow.
And because I wasn't a direct, you know, direct line person, I was not able to view the collection or to see him. Fortunately, through the dinner that was arranged for me, I found out that the ambassador just arrived into the United States. And so I was able to make an appointment with him. This was in July of last year. And I met him and I explained to him that's why I'm here. And we were able to visit Rovindovi because the ambassador, for your information, is a direct descendant of Rovindovi.
What an achievement.
And just the timing, yes, right? Yeah. Just the timing. And so to cut the long story short, it only took from July last year to this December, last weekend, that the repatriation was able to take place. Mm. And I wanted to acknowledge the ambassador, Mr. Elisoni Wunderkete and his team in Washington, D.C., and the staff of the Smithsonian Museum for making the whole smooth operation of the repatriation to take place.
Beautiful. Teresi, we've got about 2 minutes left. I just want to ask, though, do you know if there's any more remains of Fijians out there that may need to be returned home? And do you think now what has happened because of this situation, that international museums will be more open to returning remains back to their homeland?
Absolutely. So the answer is yes. There are ancestral remains of Fijian heritage in international museums. Even when I was in Germany in 2022, I was told that there are remains there, and also here in the United States. And so, yes, I'm sure with the repatriation of Robin Dobie, it will open up doors and opportunities for museums to reach out through to the Fiji Museum and through to me, because it's my area of research as well, that I will be very happy, you know, to facilitate any repatriation to take place.
That is beautiful, and obviously the great work that you've done there with Robin Dobie. We will see more of these repatriations, you know, bringing back artifacts back to their homeland. So again, thank you again for your time this morning, Dr. Teresi. Really appreciate it.
You're most welcome. Vinaka Makaleo.
Vinaka. That is Dr. Teresi Vunindilo, an archaeologist and museum specialist and assistant professor there at the California State University in Los Angeles.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Each week, Politalk dives straight into the tough questions. Like what happens if a World War II shipwreck ruptures and unleashes thousands of liters of oil into our ocean?
Across the Pacific, there's around 3,800 of these World War II shipwrecks which are potentially polluting.
On Politalk, Tuesdays, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Now, remember, you can find our top stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. And you can find us on our socials. Check us out on Facebook and Instagram. Just look for ABC Pacific. Our team will be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. But you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned, as always, to ABC Radio Australia, because you're news is next, and coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. So until next time, Otoa Ofa'ato. I'm your host, Aggie Dubol. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.